Well, the prologue to today's Satna Dhamma talk is a saying or a quote from a Greek philosopher by the name of Heraclitus of Ephesus. You cannot step twice into the same river, for other waters are ever flowing onto you. And you know, to give you another statement by the same Greek philosopher, namely, nothing endures but change. So today's Dhamma talk is going to be about change, or another word for change would be impermanence. And so, this Greek philosopher Heraclitus lived from 540 BC to 480 BC, and he was known as the philosopher of fire and flux. And instead of saying flux, you can also say a state of flux. And he is maybe one of the prominent philosophers who at a very early point in human history has noticed and verbalized this universal characteristic of impermanence with regard to nature. Now, as Shai Drori mentioned the other day, during one of the Dhamma discussions, David Hume, or wait a minute, I think it was during an interview, David Hume has made a similar statement. Is this correct? So? Close. And so, I owe this quote here by Heraclitus to Baruch, and what happened last year during the retreat in Malihapsor, Baruch was there, and towards the end of the retreat there was a Dhamma talk on impermanence. And during the following discussion with the meditators, well, it was Baruch who pointed out this link to the Greek philosopher Heraclitus. Now, today we are going to discuss impermanence, in particular with respect to the meditation practice, how impermanence can be intuitively understood in one's own meditation practice. If a meditator has meditated for some time, a couple of days or so, then sooner or later the third insight knowledge will arise. And this third insight knowledge is known as the knowledge by comprehension, samasana jnana in the Pali scriptural language. And it consists of three parts, and the first part is anicca nupassana jnana, or anicca nupassana. The second one is dukkha nupassana, and the third part is anatta nupassana. So, anicca nupassana is the contemplation on impermanence, dukkha nupassana is the contemplation on unsatisfactoriness, and anatta nupassana is the contemplation on anatta. And usually a meditator will experience first the part on impermanence, and then the portion on, or the part on unsatisfactoriness, and finally the part on anatta. And among these three, and indeed, anicca is the most easy to be experienced and to be understood. And dukkha is somewhat more difficult, and the most difficult among the three is clearly anatta. And so it's almost, it's very rare, if not impossible, for a meditator to understand anatta right away. Now, when a meditator sees the beginning of a formation, then he or she will also see the continuation of that same formation, and finally the disappearance of it. Or if you like to, the first one sees the genesis, the upada in the Pali language, and then the continuation, titi, and finally the ending, which is bhanga. And this occurs with regards not only to the rising and falling, but also many other objects. Now, there is a Pali statement with regards to this anicca nupassana that is very helpful for the general understanding. Namely, anicca nupassanam bhavento nicca sanyam pajahati, meaning one who develops the contemplation of impermanence abandons the perception the wrongful perception of permanence. Now, let us look at this term or this universal characteristic of impermanence. Now, impermanence signifies that formations are not permanent, and that they're not everlasting, and that they're originating and dissolving, and so having arisen, they then decay and finally disappear. Or, to put it differently, they are undergoing a transformation all the time. Now, discussion of anicca, and let me add one more thing, that this talk, the structure of this talk is based on a chapter of a book entitled The Seven Contemplations by the Venerable Jnana Rama. So anyway, we need to distinguish between the thing that is impermanent and the characteristic of impermanence. Now, what do you think is impermanent? The thing that is impermanent. Everything? Yes. Or to put it differently, the objects, the formations. There you go. And to stay within the Buddhist certain terminology, the formations as part of the five aggregates. The aggregate of materiality, rupakanda, the aggregate of feelings, the aggregate of perceptions, the aggregate of mental formations, and the aggregate of consciousness. So these are the things that are impermanent. And the characteristic of impermanence is that these formations of the five aggregates keep changing all the time, that they are undergoing transformation, that they never remain permanent. And impermanence is, or the characteristic of impermanence, is something that we can see in the external world in many different ways, but it's also something that we can experience within ourselves in many, many different ways. So let us look at such an external case of impermanence. Take take a flower. A flower that forms a bud. And as the days go by, the bud then gradually, the bud which appears at the end of a branch, this bud gradually then starts to blossom, and blossom into a beautiful and fragrant flower. And after it has matured, gradually it will wither away, fall to the ground, and then decompose. Or let us take the example of day and night. In the morning, the sun rises, a new day sets in, then the sun moves up all the way to the zenith, and then towards the evening it sets again, and the lightness or the light of the dark of the day gets replaced by the darkness of the night. And so the night again gets substituted by the following day. Or if you think of a human being, the whole story or the life of a human being, starting with the existence in a mother's womb as a tiny fetus, and then there is the birth, and the baby being born so small and tender, and this baby then over days, weeks, and months transforms into a small child, and out of a child becomes a young girl or boy, and out of this then grows a young adolescent with all the accompanying problems. And then this adolescent turns in a young adult, or in an adult person. And this adult person, of course, will not enjoy the fruits of the youth teens and twins forever, but gradually will grow older and older until finally the wrinkles start coming, and the teeth lose, the teeth start decaying, and the eyesight isn't what it was before, and so on and so forth. And so with each and every day, this human being that we're looking at is nearing death. And finally, death takes place. So, if this characteristic of impermanence would not exist, then we would all be beings that run around and never change. So there's no possibility to ever adjust. Even though this characteristic of impermanence is so obvious in human life, yet when one of our good friends or relatives passes away, namely death occurs, we are in tears. And why is this? Listen. Yes. Attachment. Pardon me? Attachment. Yes. And what else? Same. Anything else? Because we don't really understand impermanence. Because we are under the wrongful impression, and it's very subtle, it's on a subtle level, that this relative of ours or friend of ours is going to become 100 years. So we think, subconsciously, we think his or her life will go on forever. We're not making the necessary adjustments in our thinking. And so once the person is no more, we start missing him or her. So this is an obvious case of a wrongful perception as sudden permanence. Or we buy a brand new car and we assume that it is going to continue to be brand new for several years. And as soon as another car hits our brand new car and there's a big and causes a big dent, then we get furious because it's not in its original state anymore. We get furious because we try to maintain it in the original state. We don't want to make an allowance for impermanence. No? Ideally, we wish that our car will last 10 or even 15 years or 20 years. Yes?
I think maybe a thousand for 70 years, 50 years.
Let's discuss that later on. So many people are, especially those who do not meditate, have or assume that not only the external phenomena are permanent, but also the internal phenomena. And this particular condition you can find in yourselves again and again. Here comes some pleasant mental state, such as happiness, and what happens? No, you want it to last for as long as possible. And when you're still relatively new to the meditation practice and you haven't really understood this nature of impermanence yet, then you will try to re-experience the happiness over and over again. And so now, in order to understand the in a very profound way, to understand this universal characteristic of impermanence, we need to make certain adjustments, and we need to undertake some sort of a training. And it's very simple, namely the training in morality or in virtue, the training in concentration, and the training in wisdom. And we need to develop such mental factors as mindfulness and wisdom, or else mindfulness and clear comprehension. And it is only when we meditate like this that sooner or later a profound understanding of impermanence will arise. Now, in this connection, let me tell you about an event that took place last year or the year before in Italy during a retreat. And the Vipassana retreat was going on there. I was conducting a retreat there, and there were plenty of meditators. However, the manager of the retreat center had already, at an earlier point, accepted a group of psychologists to come for a weekend and to be at the center at the same time. So, because he had this obligation, so he moved some of the meditators out of the main building and into another building, and then the psychologists were there for about 2 days. Now, the interesting thing was that the topic of their weekend session was impermanence. So, what does impermanence mean for psychologists? Not psychologists and psychotherapists. And so, the leader of this group of psychologists, well, you know, he had a whole program there of theoretical explanations on impermanence, and then some discussions and encounters and so on and so forth. And then they invited me for they invited me for a question and answer session, and that session went very well. They got really interested, and then they joined for the Dhamma talk in the evening, and I chose the topic impermanence, and the main point was that one cannot gain a real genuine understanding of impermanence just by talking about impermanence, or by reading about impermanence, or discussing about impermanence, but rather one needs to sit down and be mindful. Of course, this was somewhat, I suppose, embarrassing for the leader of that certain group. But I can't help it. That's just a fact. And you can think as much as you like about impermanence. You'll have a theoretical understanding of impermanence, but not really a life-changing experience of it. And what we need is not to stay on the surface, but we really need to go deep. And Just recently, or in February, when my teacher was in Lumbini, so I told him about my experiences from last year's retreat in Male Hapsor in Israel, and I said, well, Venerable Sir, my feeling is that Israeli meditators are predestined to be good meditators because they have a strong sense of impermanence. And he said, no, this is incorrect. And he said, because I said, a sense of impermanence just from a general point of view, with conditions here in Israel and ever, things are changing. And he refused to accept this, saying a true understanding of impermanence only comes really out of the meditation practice. So it comes only starting with the third insight knowledge. And this is indeed correct. So, what we need to do is we need to observe a certain code of or an ethical code of conduct, and then observe whatever comes along, and then suppress the hindrances through concentration, and then when we meditate, especially during the first insight knowledge, we will see the specific characteristics of formations. So we'll see the specific characteristic of the rising, specific characteristic of the falling movement of the abdomen, specific characteristic of a pain, and so on and so forth. Now, by specific characteristic, we mean that a rising takes place and we know, the tension is there. And towards the end of the rising, the tension increases. And then there's a pain, and the specific characteristic of this pain is maybe a burning sensation. And later on, for a different pain, it could be a different sensation, and so on and so forth. And so, this seeing or understanding of the specific characteristics of formations will continue into the second insight knowledge. So the knowledge where a meditator sees cause and effect. However, once a meditator has passed that stage or accomplished that stage, then things change. And a meditator starts to see what is known as the conditioned certain characteristic of formations, namely sankhata, lakana in the Pali scriptural language. The first one, the specific characteristic is known as sabhava lakana. And so when seeing the conditioned characteristics of formations, this is said with reference to seeing the beginning of an object, the middle portion of an object, and the ending portion of an object. Now, in the very beginning of your meditation practice, you don't see like this. You can do whatever you like, but most likely you'll miss the beginning of an object, and so frequently also the ending of an object. And so only the middle portion of an object sticks out or is clearly perceptible. And in the second insight knowledge, this changes somewhat, and the meditator sees the middle of an object as the ending portion, but not yet the whole thing. Now, when one still sees the specific characteristics of formations, one at first may see an object such as the rising movement of the abdomen as a single entity. So you see it as one continuous movement. And so you can ask almost any beginning meditator, is the rising movement a continuous movement or a discontinuous movement? The person will say it's a continuous movement. But with some amount of practice, this understanding changes, and a meditator starts seeing that it isn't all that continuous, but there are some pulses in it, or it's kind of a wave-like. Or a meditator, upon closer observation, might find that it is composed of smaller constituents or smaller segments, if you like to. And so what looks like one whole entity turns out to be composed of several tiny little parts. And now, this too is already a preliminary aspect of impermanence. I guess one could say this. And so this, you see that the rising is not the same. And instead it's undergoing certain changes. Now, later on, a meditator starts seeing, as we discussed early on, the arising of an object, the continuation of an object, and the ending or dissolution of an object. And I'll give you an example, a practical example for this. A meditator who observes the fawning movement of the abdomen sees in a clear-cut manner how this fawning movement starts setting in, how it arises, and knows the very first few sensations there, or the speed of the fawning movement, and so on. And so then sees how this fawning movement changes in terms of sensations. So if early on there was a sense of mild relaxation, the relaxation might get even stronger. And then towards the ending of the fawning movement, the relaxation turns into a contraction. The contraction might even become unpleasant, painful, and then the fawning movement, the speed of it slows down, and then the movement stops, and then there might be a pause. So a meditator sees a whole lot of a great many details in one single fawning movement. And now, what is the thing that obscures the understanding of impermanence? Keep in mind that when we do not practice, or during the beginning stages of our meditation, we don't clearly see the impermanence. So what causes this? Why don't we see impermanence? Well, the reason given for this, the factor that contributes to this, is continuity itself. So there are continuity in different senses. Continuity, or if you like, your compactness, that would be more correct to say.
What about language?
Language itself. Maybe a cause. Yes, that's interesting what you're saying. And no. Well, this is. Oh, we'll get to this point. We'll get to this point later on. It has to do with perceptions and concepts. It's great. And so anyway, it's. When we observe this falling movement or rising movement, then at first we think it's continuous. And this is the superficial perception of it. But then when we go closer into the object, and that's why during the interviews again and again there's the emphasis on observing more carefully, and then we find that there is no such a thing as a continuity, but rather a movement consists or breaks up into different parts. Now, to give you another example, most people, when they think of the activity of stretching an arm, then it seems like a continuous movement. That's the usual understanding. We stretch like this. However, when we look at this process really carefully with mindfulness, we find that it keeps, or that it consists of many different segments. So it's kind of like a stop and go process. It's almost like a robot. A robot, I assume, is working along the same principle, namely of tiny, tiny, tiny little movements, which then add up to produce a larger movement. Now, there are four kinds of compactness. There is compactness as a continuity. So an object compactness. Compactness means, yes, exactly. Compactness as a continuity is what we have discussed so far. Apart from this, there's also compactness as a mass. So an object, like hardness or so, seems like a compact hardness, compact object. And at first sight. However, when we look at this object with mindfulness, we will find that this compact hardness breaks up into, or may break up into, points of hardness or patches of hardness. And these two then might be changing. Then there is compactness as a function, kichagana in the Pali scriptural language. And this means, and this is much more difficult to understand, and the understanding comes usually much, much later in the practice. You know that a particular insight knowledge has a particular function, performs a particular function. And so it seems as if this function is somewhat compact. Whenever you get to this particular place in your practice, a particular function will be performed. However, there are points or there are times when this is not the case anymore. And this compactness as a function breaks up and then things happen in a rather chaotic manner, in an unpredictable manner. Then finally, we have compactness as an object. Aramana gana in the Pali language. And this means you have an object like a pain, And at first sight, it seems pretty, you know, pretty solid, pretty compact, as if not changing whatsoever. And then, when you go into it, you penetrate it, you know, deeply, all of a sudden, you might find it explodes into hundreds or thousands of tiny little pieces. So, with that, the compactness is gone. Now, when meditator goes through these different insights and knowledges, and then he or she will find also the breaking up of yet another thing, namely our concept of a self, our notion of a self. So, most human beings, especially non-meditators, have this or assume that the self is permanent. And when they then go into the meditation practice, they find after a while, this so-called permanent self, self or ego, isn't all that permanent. And I'll give you an example for this. Beginning meditator who starts who realizes the first insight knowledge will come to the understanding that a pain is no longer my pain, but rather just a pain. Or hardness is not my hardness, but just hardness. So this is the first step on the path of the breaking up of the concept of the self. So eventually one develops more and more equanimity towards this development. When a meditator continues to practice, he or she will come to experience another aspect or another manifestation of impermanence, namely, a meditator sees formations as quickly arising and quickly passing away. And usually, at this point in the practice, the middle portion of formations is missing, is difficult to perceive. And so only the beginning phase and the ending phase of an object tends to be predominant. And so, you observe, let's say there's some hard or some hardness comes up somewhere in the body. You know it's arising, and then the next moment you realize it's gone. So the arising is clear, the ending of it is also clear, but the middle portion is not clear yet, or is not clear. So what this is, it's a further developed stage of the third insight knowledge. And things are happening already much, much faster than early on. And so when a meditator then continues to practice, he or she will come across a new development, namely that quite naturally the mind falls mostly onto the endings of formations. So the beginnings of formations are no longer interesting. The mind simply just doesn't pay attention to them. And so the middle portion is, well, somewhat accessible, somewhat perceptible, and most predominant is the ending. Now, when a meditator sees most formations as just dissolving, 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 and then this brings about a very profound understanding of impermanence. So basically, you see the death again and again. You see the death of formations. You see the dissolution of formations. And this experience is said to be the climax of the understanding of impermanence. And, or, well, maybe not quite the absolute climax, but already a relatively high point in the development of impermanence. And if a meditator then goes on to practice and eventually reaches the knowledge of equanimity about formation, sankopeka jnana, and the mind becomes quite balanced and the controlling faculties are well developed, and then the mind may fall onto some object, and the object will be seen in the mode of impermanence, and with impermanence, or by seeing impermanence of a particular object, a meditator then enters the door, the gateway to liberation. And with this, path knowledge and fruition knowledge take place, and both of these take Nibbana as an object. So the culmination of impermanence comes with, or may come with, the experience of path and fruition knowledge. But please keep in mind that there are also other ways of attaining path and fruition knowledge, and this we will discuss tomorrow during our talk. At the outset of the talk, it was mentioned that developing the contemplation of impermanence abandons the wrongful perception of permanence. And it's said there, one who develops, Bawen To. And so in order, so the question arises, what are some of the factors that that contribute towards this development of the contemplation of impermanence? And the texts certainly say, number one, to maintain or ensure a balance of the two pairs. Two pairs, of the first pair being effort and concentration, and we've heard this certainly before in one of the previous Dhamma talks, as well as the balance of the second pair consisting of faith and wisdom. And furthermore, the controlling faculties, namely faith, effort, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom, these need to be brought to maturation. And so they should be directed towards a single purpose, namely that of attaining the Dhamma. The third, another factor that is helpful for the development of the contemplation of impermanence is that of the maintenance of effort. And what do you think? Should the effort ideally be excessive, or should it be slack? Or maybe something else? Yes, indeed. So it should be well balanced. And so, just like the Buddha's teachings are about the middle path, so too, or the same principle can be applied to the meditation practice. Mental factors like effort and concentration and so on, they should be well balanced. And so, a fourth factor that is said to be contributing towards the development of this contemplation of impermanence is the reinforcement by constant practice. Now, what are the benefits to be gained from this contemplation of impermanence? Number one, it leads eventually to the intuitive understanding of anicca, of impermanence, and with this, a meditator abandons the wrongful perception as permanent. And this happens by way of substitution. Substitution of opposites. And so, as mentioned already earlier on, this seeing or understanding of impermanence helps us to, gradually let go of the concept of self. And this contemplation of impermanence also helps us to understand that so far we've been deceived in terms of perception. And when we're a victim or subject of a distortion of our perception, and this is known as sanya vipalasa in the Pali scriptural language, and this happens because of ignorance, and then this distortion of perception will gather some momentum, and it will lead to a distortion of our consciousness. So, if again and again we perceive objects wrongfully as permanent, then this will have an effect on the mind. It will influence our consciousness. And so it leads to a distortion of consciousness, and this in turn will then lead to a distortion of views. And so if it happens like this again and again, eventually we come to believe that formations are permanent. However, through the development of Vipassana meditation, as explained early on, gradually we come to see objects or formations according to reality, and so with this distortion of perception will be rectified. As a result of this, the distortion of consciousness will also be rectified, and so as a result of this, it comes to a change, our distortion of views will also be changed. Now, to bring about this change of distortions, we need to practice again and again, and we need to see the impermanence of formations again and again. So this is a big task. Now, let me conclude today's Dhamma talk by wishing that through the development of mindfulness and the other relevant controlling faculties, may you gradually see through the wrongful perceptions as certain compactness of an object, and may you see through the continuity of certain formations, and then discover in a very direct and intuitive way for yourselves the impermanence of all formations, impermanence of the formations connected with the five aggregates, and may this and seeing lead you on to the final experience of path knowledge and fruition knowledge and the realization of Nibbana. And this is it for today. We have time for some comments, questions. Shai, why don't you repeat what you said early on? Early on I didn't quite catch. could you speak up?
Yes, examples for
what's it?
Deceased before his time.
Oh, deceased before his time. Oh, the child. Oh, eh?
Or a soldier or someone in the age of
young
below, oh, say 40 or something.
Eh? But so what then is the, you know, the average and the whole lifespan, assumed lifespan?
Let's say about 90 is okay.
90, that's pretty high. Shai was just trying to make the point. Nonetheless, in both cases, whether a child passes away or elderly citizen or senior citizen passes away, grief will be there. Maybe your point is there are different degrees of grief. But to a mother who loses her only child, it may be also a strong grief might arise. And so that's who knows? It's difficult to say. Okay. Any other points? Yes, Ruhama.
Yeah.
Yes, indeed it is. And in the Dhamma talk scheduled for tomorrow, there'll be a little bit more of that. And if you'd like to, I can put some more information in there. And stream entry is or path knowledge. Wait a minute. Path knowledge and fruition knowledge are the technical terms that correspond to or that relate to stream entry. So this experience of stream entry on first level of enlightenment has to technically can be broken down into first the occurrence of path. And as mentioned already many times now, with this comes about the eradication of certain unwholesome mental states, and it's just one single moment of consciousness, and this then will be followed by either two or three moments of fruition consciousness, and later on a meditator can have many more fruition experiences, and those over time might get longer and longer, not just two or three moments. No, in both of these forms of consciousness, path consciousness and fruition consciousness, take Nibbana as an object, and Nibbana is very different from your ordinary experiences. So it's a non-sensate experience. More on it tomorrow. Yeah. Yes, Anant.
Would you like to compliment the subject of
life? On impermanence and the preciousness of life.
Something to.
Yeah, well, there's much to say there. Please keep in mind that it's very. There's a Dhammapada verse that says human birth is precious. It's a rare opportunity for a being that goes through samsara, through the rounds of a round of births and deaths. It's a rare opportunity to gain this human birth. We take it for granted, and so we think it's normal to gain this human birth. But if we're not careful with our actions, then in the future we might lose this privilege in terms of the next existence. And so when when we have gained this precious and rare opportunity of a human birth, we should make very good use of it, and always keeping in mind that death can occur at any time. No? This is another point where our perception tends to cheat us or fools us. We have this notion, most of us have this notion, well, we're going to live like what somebody said, 90 years. No? So if you have this basic assumption of living for 90 years, you will be tempted to postpone your meditation practice until next year, and again next year, and maybe 5 years from now, or 10 years from now, saying, oh well, I still have plenty of time, I can do it once I've gained my, or once I go into retirement. And by then you might have, other interests, And so just one. And so the Buddhist texts say that not only can death occur at any time, whether we're young or the middle age or an elderly person, but also death can occur, and or we never know where death will take place and in which form it will take place. So, are we knowing already ahead of time how our death is going to be? Are we going to die in a car accident, or are we going to die naturally, going to bed at night and not waking up next morning? No. Or, ideally, are we going to pass away sitting in full lotus and meditating? This will be the best. No. From Buddhist perspective, this is to be pursued. So, just saying. So, and then preciousness of the human existence. Or there's another aspect to this preciousness, because as human beings, we have the opportunity to come in contact with the Buddha's Dhamma. No. As a celestial being with no body, no material form, only mentality, there's no ears, and thus no possibility to hear the Dhamma, and thus no instructions and nothing. And furthermore, we live in a place and in a time where the Dhamma is still available. Even though the Buddha has passed away, Gautama Buddha has passed away, yet his teachings are available in this country. No? And just to think, maybe 100 years earlier in history, probably on this soil, there was nobody interested in Buddhism. And nobody knowing anything about Buddhism. Nobody in the position to teach anything about this form of meditation. So now we live in a place and in a time where these teachings are available. And so as long as these teachings are available, we should make good use of them. And practice as long as we're young and healthy in conditions permit. So that's the connection or some aspects regarding to preciousness of human existence and impermanence. So things can change, conditions can change at any time from between now and tomorrow morning. No, Yiga.
Yeah, I just want to add that in my it's ending for briefly moments, I'm dead.
Yes.
And it's so precious to know that it's coming again.
Yes.
In this moment, it's so strong for me. It's like you never know if it will come or not.
No.
this is the impermanence of life.
Yes, right.
Suddenly you realize that it's not changed, you know, it's finished. And then maybe it will come, maybe it won't. But it's so precious to know that every moment it's like a way of thinking, a way of looking on things. In every moment become really like precious moment because
right.
You understand it, it's not so obvious, it's because the breathing is finished in some place.
One more aspect to, you know, to what you've said. The contemplation of impermanence, so seeing, you know, the birth of or the genesis of formations, the continuation of formations, and the death of formations is a wonderful preparation in a small way for death. So if you keep seeing the, you know, formations coming and going, and then gradually you get used or you get more familiar, you know, with death, that's the death of our human existence, that might occur at a later point. And with that, there's then less fear of it. Oh, no, there's no need for that. Yes, Morty?
You talked before about the next life. Why should I bother about the next life? In this term?
Well, no. The my teacher has he's given talks, and based on these talks, a book was published in America and in Sri Lanka, and the title of this book is "In This Very Life."
Mm-hmm.
And what do you mean? What do you think it refers to? Well, that one should do, you know, the practice in this very life. One should attain, you know, the Dhamma in this very life, and not postpone the whole thing to a future existence.
It's useful knowledge in a feeling of changing my life.
It's good.
For other person, for other form of life.
Yeah, good. No. Anything else? Yes, it's me.
You mentioned that
there's side open, it is more, yeah?
Maybe,
we'll keep that for the end of the retreat, no?
Yeah. In the end of the retreat, we'll
have a reading list.
Yeah, we'll have a list.
There will be a list, with recommended reading and places to practice, and I don't know what you're coming up with.
If you have anything else, just put a note, ask for it. Then we can prepare it before the end of the
day. Sitting groups, contact some persons, and so on. I know. Okay. Anything else? Yeah, yes, Baruch?
Yeah, what about this? I don't know if there's any reference in the...
Yes, no. If I'm not mistaken, this whole discussion comes under, or this whole topic comes under, you know, the Pali term, panyati, which means, concept. And language is clearly seen, as a concept, and not as ultimate reality.
Yes,
no?
But this is the problem, if you're attached to the language, and you can continue to the answer. For example, if you go, to understand it, you don't go twice to the same river. You go for 1 o'clock, you cross the Hudson River. Then you come back in 3 o'clock after, you don't realize that, it's a river and water, because I crossed
out
the river again.
For your question, if I have the time, I'll check in the comprehensive manual of Abhidhamma, and whether there's some more on language there. Offhand, I wouldn't know. You have anything?
Yeah. I have one comment maybe it has to do.
Speak up.
In this name.
Very wide.
Yeah.
Very wide, very deep for us.
Exactly. And
in
this condition, in this state,
condition
is very
conditioned world. Yeah. There you go.
If it's personal, this is the personal development.
It's the same. Never mind. mind if it's a mountain or it's an it, or it's a tree, or it's a blah blah blue.
So don't see it.
And this is exactly the.
Well, the point, Baruch, the point that you're making, that language might also contribute to the covering up of impermanence, that point is definitely a good point. As human beings, I guess, we tend to, or the way the mind works, we tend to work with concepts frequently, and this working with concepts prevents us in many cases from actually observing what is. So let's say that table there, so we just see it once, we put the concept on it, and this is a table, we don't look at it anymore, and then we don't even know the details of this table. No? So it prevents us from a real careful observation. Mm-hmm. And then we don't realize that maybe at the beginning of the retreat the table has four legs and now it has only maybe three legs or whatever. And, okay, anything else?
What is the language the passage, the way, the Dhamma way, you do it by yourself. Tune the language to discuss it. You need the language just to discuss it, to show it to other persons.
So, and one important point, and I'm not quite sure whether I mentioned it already during a previous discussion or not. Venerable Analayo, in his book Satipatthana, points out that a certain amount of verbalization in the context of Vipassana meditation is possible, or is just part of it, and it does not interfere with the unfolding of wisdom. So the way it just works is that if we sit in meditation and we then label and mentally observe what's happening, or that we tell, okay, now this is happening, that is happening, and so on, this does not interfere with the process. Certain, please. To some extent, the internal experiences that we have, we can verbalize these and discuss these with another person to some extent. And that is one of the reasons why during the interviews the meditators are being encouraged again and again, please try to be more precise in your, both in the observation as well as the description of the phenomena happening in the practice. Rather than just giving a very general report and not saying anything, it's really helpful for the interview, but also for the meditator himself or herself, to be really precise in the observation and in the verbalization of it. And especially later on in the practice, when things become extremely refined, or experiences become refined, the mind itself becomes refined, and so. If you as a meditator haven't developed the skill of observing properly, precisely, later on, you'll miss the main experience. No.
The object of the awareness, I walk, my awareness is the gear. It's what's going on. Usually we think we breathe from here to the stomach. Okay, no, but I can breathe to...
Okay. That seems like all for tonight. It's 7 o'clock. And let's end for now.